listening to Radio Zapatista, broadcasting from the KPFA studios in Berkeley. In the studio today, we have the Amateur Dream Team, Victoria, Tyler, and myself, Jessica. And on the controles, we have Pedro. Today, we will be focusing on some local Zapatista struggles for autonomy and self-determination. We have a live interview with our compañero Joaquin of Los Angeles, followed by a special documentary that begins to explore the politics of learning. Stay with us, and we'll be right back after this short musical break. Joaquin Cienfuegos is a well-known community organizer in Los Angeles. He is part of Popwatch LA, Revolutionary Autonomous Communities, and is well-networked among different anti-authoritarian and autonomous organizing efforts across the country. On June 26, Joaquin was stopped and arrested by police in Los Angeles while driving his friend home. It is our understanding that they were pulled over without proper reason. After an illegal search of his car, the cops found a legally purchased firearm in Joaquin's trunk. For this, Joaquin was arrested and is now being charged with illegal possession of a concealed weapon. After various organizing efforts nationally and internationally, enough money was raised to pay part of Joaquin's bail. He was released this past Monday, July 7th, and is here to talk to us a little bit about the recent events. I think that for a lot of us, while we found the news of your arrest upsetting, it didn't necessarily come as a surprise. I think it's obvious that the LAPD was waiting for the perfect opportunity to lock you up, basically, on some trumped-up charges, just as they've done with the leadership of the Black Riders Liberation Party and to many other people of color organizing in their communities. Do you think you can talk about the reasons why the LAPD would choose to target you specifically and how your arrest fit into the larger all-out attack against young people of color?
Well, I think, as you mentioned, you know, it speaks to the situation and the conditions that we're living in Los Angeles. The Los Angeles Police Department, you know, on a daily basis just goes after young people of color, locks them up, criminalizes them. They have all these laws to you know, do that, to justify what they're doing, you know, with the gang enhancement laws, gang injunctions, which further militarizes police. And looks at people that are living in these conditions, are being brought up in these conditions as urban terrorists. I think that's an actual quote from the mayor and the chief of police. They've actually called a lot of these street gangs urban terrorists, and it kind of justifies what they're doing and just locking them up. And it's part of the prison industrial complex and the overall war that they have waged in our communities and in the neo-colonies as we see them, you know, basically because, you know, people that are living in the communities don't have any control of what gets done, you know, and the people who are put in power, the so-called leaders, might look like us, might, you know, come from the same community, but really don't represent our interests. They represent the interests of white supremacy, of imperialism, patriarchy. Right. You know, and that's basically what, you know, we're living in Los Angeles. And like the Black Riders, they call this the red zone because, as we know, you know, Los Angeles has been on the front of all these attacks, but also has a history of rebellion. You know, from 1965 to 68, 1992, people have been rebelling, you know, against the LAPD, the racism that they experience on a daily. So it's not like people are just lying back and taking it, you know. And part of it, I think that, you know, the attack on me came from the police as part of, yeah, repression. And this can happen to anybody, you know, anybody who, you know, stands up and fights back and resists. It's going to be, you know, seen as a threat by the system, by the state. So, you know, like the Black Riders Liberation Party is just one example. And members of Cop Watch Los Angeles, you know, have been on the spotlight as well. Not since we came out, since we've been out there organizing. from the case of William Cardenas, where the police in Hollywood, the same cops who arrested me, actually, you know, were exposed for beating up this young Chicano in the streets and brought there, like, choking him and punching him in the face. And we helped expose that along with the family of William, you know. And since then, I think the police have been, you know, kind of looking for the right time to come after us.
Can you talk a little bit about Cop Watch LA and the Revolutionary Autonomous Communities for those folks out there listening who don't know about these groups? Just tell us a little bit about what you guys do.
Okay, so Cop Watch LA, you know, we got started about 2 years ago actually, around specific cases of police brutality. One case was Susie Lopez Peña, a 19-month-old baby who was shot and washed by the LAPD, by SWAT team actually. She was being held in her father's arms, and the police, instead of trying to negotiate with the father to let the baby go, they shot both of them in cold blood and they let him just, you know, die there in front of all the people that live in Watts, in that area, in their neighborhood. You know, and another case was Devin Brown, a 13-year-old black youth and stuff who was killed in the Compton area, in Inglewood area, I think, where the police stopped him. They were chasing after him. They stopped his car. He was reaching for his wallet. He didn't have his license, and they shot him, and they killed him. And there's other cases of DeAndre Brunson, who was shot in Compton in front of his house. And the police shot their dog, their own dog, at the same time. They killed him. And instead of helping him, they airlifted their canine and let him die there on his porch. Yeah, and we were just tired, you know. We were just upset. A lot of the young people who come from these neighborhoods, people of color, you know, we were just upset, you know. Not only upset, but we wanted to do something about it. And we feel that the only way we're going to stop it is if we take direct action before that murder happens, before that brutality happens, and build real power, build institutions in our communities, you know, where we actually stop depending on the police and start relying on ourselves.
Right. So basically making a case for autonomy in our communities.
Yeah. And that's what, you know, we figured that, you know, needed to happen. That's why we created the Revolutionary Autonomous Communities. And within that, you know, we need to build other programs, other institutions of the people, or the or community councils, where people can actually have the ability to get together face to face and talk about not only the issues that are affecting them, but work towards, you know, building something, you know, building a the world that they want to see right now, you know. And part of that, you know, RAC, we were able to kind of do that and build a space for that, mm-hmm. so people can actually, you know, start meeting up and not only talking about, like, the ideas and the principles, but also the practice, you know. And a lot of us were anarchists, but we thought that, you know, we needed to create something that's more relevant to us, you know, to indigenous people, to, you know, people of color, and kind of that it's rooted in our communities. And that's why we created RAC. And even though we do have anarchist principles, we feel that the movement is more important. And we're not, you know, a vanguardist type organization where we feel we have all the answers. We have more to learn from the people than we got to teach them. And that's why we, you know, we need that autonomous space, you know, and the space to create that self-determination, the self-organization. And Cop Watch, we feel that, you know, it's a process for building that self-defense that's needed as well. So you can safeguard what we create in our communities. Because anything that we create, that's in opposition to capitalism, is going to be seen as a threat and it's going to be destroyed or smashed by the state.
Right. So we're running out of time, Hakeem. Thank you so, so much for speaking to us. I know you must be crazy busy, having just gotten out and trying to catch up with family and friends and community. But real quick before you go, want to ask, what are some things that people can do to support you in your case and other folks like the Black Writers Liberation Party who are under legal attack?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that solidarity with each other is our best defense. And right now we're trying to raise funds to kind of pay the people back that helped bail me out.
Right.
It was like a couple thousand, you know, and so we're doing fundraising events, and people can do that in their own city. We have a website up. It's called DIYZINE.com/FreeJoaquin. And people can go there and get more information. And also for the Black Riders, there's an event on July 12th called the Summer Solidarity Festival. And there's also a website for that on DIYZINE.com. Or they can go to copwatchla.org to get more information. But, you know, we have to have solidarity with each other and start building some real principles. Mm-hmm. That's the only way we're going to get free.
Well, we will keep in touch with you and follow your case, and we really wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for talking to us.
Como extraño mi sabana hermosa metida en la cordillera, esperando que llegue la hora de regresar a mi tierra. En el valle de Cubeta me he metido, lejanía que me tiene entristecido. En mi pecho florece una cumbia de la nostalgia como una lágrima que se escapa. Cumbia del alma, cumbia que madruga sobre Cubeta con insistencia buscando a Huaca. Ahí me va, qué tristeza que me da.
The following documentary covers the recent denial of reappointment of a compañera that is a professor here in California and is part of the Zapatista Network in the state and globally. The documentary uses the analysis of various individuals from Acción Zapatista de Humboldt. Together we tried to uncover what role learning plays in the struggle for autonomy and dignity. By examining how this collective critiques a traditional place of learning, in their case the university, and by looking at the strategies they have used to say ya basta to the mainstream learning process that advances the agenda of the privileged. We hope to share ways of learning that extends dignity to people who are regularly ignored, repressed, and marginalized.
Until the philosophy which owed one race superior and another inferior is finally and permanently discredited and abandoned. Everywhere is war. It's a war that until there are no longer first class and second class citizens of any nation, until the color of a man's skin is of no.
In May of 2008, Dr. Manuel Callahan was denied reappointment for a sixth year as a full-time professor in the Ethnic Studies program at Humboldt State University in Northern California. For many, this act on behalf of the university represents nothing less than institutional and epistemic racism. Dr. Callahan is an inspiring and dedicated scholar who has changed the lives of hundreds of students through his engaging and relevant teaching methods. In addition to being a professor and mentor, Manuel is part of Acción Zapatista de Humboldt, a collective inspired by the Zapatistas' process of learning and resistance. Since his arrival at Humboldt State, Manolo has been a key figure in mobilizing political energy and bridging the divide between different communities, both on and off campus. The university, however, has continually undermined his intellectual authority, specifically targeting his work surrounding race and his efforts to make transparent the ways in which race and racism operate within Humboldt State specifically and the American University in general. The attempts on the part of the university to delegitimize Dr. Callahan's efforts serves to further reinforce the white power structure under which so many of us struggle to exist.
Manolo was able to focus on getting students together and organizing students in a way that our kind of perspective, our knowledge was being valued, and also in a way that was like pushing us to analyze the situation in ways where we were learning, we were growing. But also, we were part of a process of kind of creating an organization, creating like a collective or a community where our voices were valued. And I think a lot of times faculty approach students with a kind of model of how to organize, you know, already established. And most of the organizing that happens on campus is, you know, you're supposed to put on events that are pre-planned, that are annual events. And you're learning how to go through the motions of like managing a bureaucracy.
and your vision or your creativity is not utilized or valued. I think in that way we're like fighting for something that we determine.
Because of the important role that Manolo has played in advancing the politics of Savatismo in Humboldt and beyond, a direct action was organized in defense of his reappointment.
We were in the vice president's office when we were jamming up his office. One of the things he tried to claim was he had no authority in this whole decision-making process where he's the last person to make that decision. If he would have said yes or no, it makes an impact, you know? He lied to me in my face and said that to me. That just proves to you how people are invested in this institution of neoliberal university. They are totally pushing for the privatization of knowledge production. We're trying to challenge that by getting Manolo reappointed, because without Manolo, a lot of the organizing efforts around this community wouldn't have happened.
On Monday, May 12, 2008, a group of 60 students, staff, faculty, alumni, community members, and local activists occupied the office of Provost of Academic Affairs, Robert Snyder, to show their support for the continued tenure-track employment of Dr. Callahan. Snyder was handed an extensive letter signed by over 80 people evaluating Professor Callahan's work in Humboldt County over the last 5 years and insisting on his reappointment to a sixth.
What we were trying to say in organizing this is that we are aware of what's happening. Like, we're not just sitting there consuming this bank teller mode of education that the university has perfected, you know? We're actually watching and aware of what's happening, and we're ready to act when it comes down to it, especially when there's instances of physical violence, emotional, spiritual violence happening with people, students, faculty, and staff. Who knows about administrators?
In their letter to Snyder, the protester stated, quote, "We believe that due to his political work, inherent in the engaging, creative, and challenging ways he teaches ethnic studies, Manolo is being racially and politically profiled," end quote.
When we were organizing around Manolo's situation, is not only that we care about Manolo, because he has challenged us in ways that no other professor on campus has, but it's also about making a statement to this university and saying, you have to start including the voices of the marginalized communities and the outside community and the students.
It is important to remember that Dr. Callahan's dismissal is not an isolated incident, but that it is just one example occurring in the context of a larger trend within the U.S. education system that seeks to punish those who refuse to take part in the neoliberal reorganization of public education and who remain critical of the dominant institutions within the U.S. We give you the following examples. Example A. In February of 2008, Native American scholar Andrea Smith was denied tenure at the University of Michigan. Smith is one of the most referenced, transformative, and intellectually dynamic scholars in Native studies today. In 2005, Smith published her groundbreaking book entitled Conquest, Sexual Violence and American Indian Genocide. She is a co-founder of Insight, Women of Color Against Violence, and a leading member of the Boarding School Healing Project, as well as the Chicago chapter of Women of All Red Nations. The tenure decision was seen by people across the country as an affront to Native and Indigenous studies, as well as to those who center their work in political struggle. Example B. In April 2008, Arizona passed Senate Bill 1108, which states that public tax dollars in public schools, quote, shall not be used to promote ideological or cultural beliefs or values that denigrate, disparage, or overtly encourage dissent from the values of American democracy and Western civilization, including capitalism, end quote. The bill also prohibits organizations based in whole or in part on race-based criteria to operate on all public campuses. This measure would make groups such as Mecha illegal in the way that they currently function and completely dismantle programs such as Raza Studies. Example C. In May of 2008, Karen Salazar, a second-year English teacher at Jordan High School in Watts, California, was refused renewal of her contract and was accused of presenting a biased view of the curriculum and indoctrinating her students with Afrocentrism. Among her course materials were board-approved texts by Malcolm X and Langston Hughes. This decision will bar Salazar from teaching within the Los Angeles Unified School District in the future. In Humboldt, members of Acción Zapatista explain the tactics that the university uses to manage and limit the kind of learning that takes place within the classroom. Among their tactics is the liberal use of terms such as multiculturalism and diversity, a language spoken to mask the ways in which the voices of students of color are actively suppressed and instead replaced with tokenistic performances in which the white population on campus consumes and exotifies their culture. Nowhere is there room to interrogate the ways in which we can dismantle the power relations that undermine the knowledge and struggle of our communities.
The type of multiculturalism that existed on campus didn't really have an anti-racist agenda. So it didn't really challenge white supremacy or power relations that were organized around it. So a lot of it was what we call boutique multiculturalism, where groups would be asked to get up and perform a dance or celebrate with the food, you know, that was supposed to represent their culture. Basically, these were celebratory events that often tended to objectify communities of color and put culture on display as something to be consumed. And the celebration of culture was completely disconnected from the struggles that those same communities were enduring or engaged in.
Dominant institutions in general use different methods to silence and jump on communities. The entire colonial project has and continues to rely on acquiescence and complicity, divide and conquer, and co-optation of cultural expression. Universities employ many of the same tactics as other institutions in order to make white supremacy and racial hierarchies invisible. For many schools, diversity is constructed as a problem that needs to be fixed, and diversity means people of color. So there are always token gestures and a culture of tokenism that allows for the realities of racism to be masked by institutions, even as these locations reproduce and reinforce inequality. Issues of representation are resolved by having a few key brown and black faces in the right places, without any serious engagement with or commitment to increasing the number of students of color on college campuses or any interrogation of power and privilege. Universities are institutions that wield a lot of power because they are locations of knowledge production. What is determined as valid or legitimate knowledge, however, often reflects the ideologies of the dominant society, which means that they are places where racism, sexism, classism, homophobia, xenophobia, etc. are upheld and constantly reproduced. Scholars who try to work against dominant ideologies are often dismissed as irrelevant or outdated. The situation with ethnic studies is one that I can only describe as a crisis. The few departments or programs that still exist have serious choices to make about the direction of the kind of intellectual work that is to be associated with the discipline. Although born out of the political, social, and economic struggles of U.S. people of color, especially Black and Chicano, this history is now disregarded. The commitment to community has also been removed. For the folks who are serious about deconstructing hierarchies and oppressive practices, they are usually met with resistance and are forced to continually prove the legitimacy of their research and intellectual production, even as ethnic studies programs continue to claim commitment to oppressed communities. A question that I grapple with because of this experience as a third-year grad student in ethnic studies is this. Will ethnic studies continue to exist as an oppositional discipline in the university? From my perspective, ethnic studies has already been co-opted by academic institutions, and is always attempting to prove its legitimacy as an academic discipline, not as the intervention that it was initially intended to be. Because of this, scholars no longer have the comfort that the work they do on race, gender, class, etc. is a kind of work that will allow them to support their research and positions as students. It is also easy then to dismiss knowledge produced that does not fall in line with the status quo. One of the tragedies of this mindset is the move away from scholarship that attempts to describe actual conditions of state and other violences that people of color experience daily and in everyday life.
It is clear that the function of educational institutions is not to promote learning, but rather to perpetuate the system of exploitative capitalist hierarchies that rely on destructive power relations such as racism, patriarchy, homophobia, ableism, etc., in order to secure the reproduction and maintenance of its own existence. If this is true, then we are left with this question. how do we come together as a community to create ways of learning that are based in dignity and allow space for a multiplicity of knowledges to be shared, acknowledged, and respected?
Our hope in airing this documentary is to begin a dialogue about taking learning into our own hands, because we know that the schools and state institutions that we have access to do not necessarily put our needs and desires first. The second part of this documentary will be aired next month and explores and shares practical examples of how Action Zapatista has used tools inspired by the Zapatistas to explore the political potential of creating autonomous learning communities in Humboldt County. Please email us at radiozapatista@gmail.com to share comments and resources that further our understanding of insurgent learning communities.
Just listen to Radio Zapatista Chiapas No Se Olvida. We will be back next month, first Friday and second Friday every month at 9 p.m. Listen to us on 94.1 KTFA in Berkeley. And we want to thank La Onda Bajita for this space. Our website is www.radiozapatista.org.